Thank you very much, and thank you so much for the invitation to this highly unlikely event, I would say, which is also emotionally significant to me because one of my teachers was the French philosopher mathematician René Thom, who received a Fields Medal in 1965. We are very proud of that. It's a sort of mathematical Nobel Prize of some kind from this place. So this is special. I'm only going to address one little thing, I think, today. I have many ideas in this field that I would like to discuss maybe in the following debate. But initially, I'll just address one, namely the semiotic status of numbers. Let's see. In fact, the semiotic status of numbers were made an intensely interesting topic in the recent development of metaphor analysis, expressed with particular emphasis in Lakoff's and Nunez's book on the origins of mathematics, which I take to mean where mathematics might be coming from in evolutionary terms. I mean, there are many other ways in which you can come from something. They could be derivable from something in an axiomatic framework, for example, but that's not what the claim is, as I understand it. The claim is an evolutionary claim. So the shortest version of that would be to say, and I quote from that book, numbers are things in the world. So that's considered to be a grounding arithmetic metaphor, said that human beings see things as other things. A is B in the standard formula for conceptual metaphor, and numbers enter into the framework of analysis by conceptual metaphor, according to the authors here, so that there are numbers as abstract entities because there are less abstract entities in the world that we call things, and the metaphor is then considered as creating by inference the meaning of what's in A by inference from B, what is in numbers as inferenced from B, the things in the world. On the other hand, it is said by the same authors that numerals can be considered as particular symbols for particular numbers. Symbols constitute, of course, a semiotic relation. That semiotic relation has nothing metaphorical in it, but the two statements together summarize Lakoff and Nunez's metaphoric or half-metaphoric semiotics, by which numerical symbols would be symbols of numbers and numbers would be of things. So that would be the order of that reasoning. My problem is that numbers are cognitively independent on numeral symbols, since they are things cognitively independent of symbolic expressions, since the symbolization of numbers do not enter into the consideration by conceptual metaphor. So if you try to derive numbers by conceptual metaphor, what happens to the symbolization of numbers? They are left totally out of the perspective on this view. So I have to ask, how does a number of things become a number in itself seen as a thing? I think it sounds close to something that John here could have written somewhere, I think, no? Well, let's discuss that. No, I say thing because I quote Lakoff and Nunez on thing. They don't have objects. That's too complicated. the problem is metaphor does not explain the semiotic relation of symbol to number. if there are symbols of numbers that make it possible to distinguish symbol and number in a relationship. So if the metaphor were operative, it would be reflected, by the way, in language. That's another thing to consider, especially if you are a linguist. Number terms would denote things then if they were based on a cognitive relation of the metaphorical sort, no? So if the mind thinks that numbers are things, the mind that constitutes this structure by metaphor, then let's see if language reflects that relation. There goes a two. That would be a couple, of course, but languages prefer couple to two. The two is on my table. That's scissors, for example. But we don't use strict cardinal terms for numbers in that way, which indicates that language is not happy with that theory, in a sense. Since number terms are not easily used as nouns. For some of my colleagues, they are adjectives instead. But take a look upon what they do with adjectives in the surroundings of nouns. The red ripe tomatoes can be said the ripe red tomatoes. And I can say the two red tomatoes, so why is two not an adjective? Well, you can't say the red two tomatoes, because they behave as to word order structurally in a different way. They behave as if they were quantifiers, which I think they are. So we get, for example, all nine cats were black. All of the nine cats were black. All the nine cats were black. Some were white. If I just say some, I can imply of the, for example, nine cats. So some goes into a genitive relation with a phrase where the number is. So in 4A and B, there were a number of them, and there's no exception to that. All refers to a number with the idea of not subtracting from it. So you get all nine without exception. Whereas some again refers to the number, but now you can subtract for it. So it's the number k, for example, 9 minus x. There is a syntactic expression of that. For example, if I say all the cats were black, you get a stemmatic structure of this kind in the simulinguistic representation I'm working with. You see what it means. 7 is the node where you will find the quantifiers, and that's where 9 is. And the quantifier goes into a genitive relation with the all sum. So the quantity appears to collaborate with the logical quantifiers, so in such a way that the logical quantifiers have to refer semantically to the numerical quantifiers, namely the number terms. Equally, if you squeeze out the genitive, so you get all nine, all the nine cats, the all cats, all the cats, all nine, all the nine cats, you see that the nine will then modify all in such a way that you get a compound quantifier. That's what language does, not only in English, but in all the languages I've checked it on, especially the Romance languages. Okay, number terms, what word class are they then? I think it would make sense to consider them proper names for numbers instead. Proper names are given within a paradigm of proper names for numbers. Proper names for things in general pertain to paradigms for them. They appear on closed, relatively closed lists, like paradigms for person proper names. So you have personal proper names, you have proper names for places where the paradigm is, of course, encyclopedic. You have paradigms for numbers. We'll take a look upon those. Paradigms of number terms are culturally cyclic. They are cycles, and they are given in paradigms that have that cyclic character. So you get in many terminologies things like dozens, scores, tens. Think of the odd systems that are vigesimal, like part of the French, 80, which is a multiplum of 20. Think of the Nordic languages like Danish, where you have 50, which means 2.5 times 20 is 50, etc. 60, 3 times 20, 4 times 20, 80, 90, which is halfway from 4 to 5 times 20 is 90, etc. Terminologies like those are of course referenced on the cycle, namely 20, or the cycle could be 12, it could be something else, but there must be a cycle. Number terms are, on the other hand, indeclinable, like proper names. They do not use suffixes for gender, and especially not for number, of course, since number is what they are indicating. And this may be why they behave as proper names, because they are proper names. That's my hypothesis. What do they mean then? Well, next hypothesis is that they mean something that is signified graphically in the first place. So here is something that Saussure would have found horrible, namely a vocal signifier for a graphic signifier. He would say all graphic signifiers are servants to the vocal signifier. They are subservient to the voice. Now here is a voice that is subservient to a graphic, and I think it makes sense to see it that way. Which means that I can write the 90 and mean 90, where what I'm writing is not 90 at all. I'm writing something cyclic, but I'm referring to another cyclic system. I'm talking in a vigesimal system into a decimal system. One is vigesimal, the other is decimal. How is that possible? Well, because there is a semiotic distance between the two. And the graphic gestural signifier in terms will then mean a counting event. So the graphic signifier is again part of some cyclic paradigm. And we get something like this as a possible representation in the dialect used by Roland Barthes, for example. You have a signifier with a signified, which is again a compound of signifier and signified. The word signifies another sign which has a signifier, the graph, and the graph signifies something which I strongly suppose to be a counting event. And the counting event has a signified meaning, namely the multiplex that is given there. That multiplex doesn't have to be cyclic at all, which is why we had to distinguish between cyclic symbolization of number and number in itself. Number in itself, mathematical number, is independent of the cyclicity of its symbolization, right? Otherwise, we would have a non-cyclical number system where we would have an unending set of terms for multiples with totally unrealistic condition of handling. The only example of a non-cyclic symbolic system is given by a text by Jorge Luis Borges, Funes el Memorioso, a man who falls from the horse and damaged his head, so now the cyclic symbolization falls out. And when he talks about things after 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, he goes on with tables and chairs and fruits and vegetables and animals and on and on and on forever. He has absolute memory, so that works for him. But he can't understand abstraction and he can't do multiplication. So what is counting? Well, you have to count something, no? In a sense, here. Ah, sheep, for example. That's interesting because in sheep counting, you don't really need there to be the things we call sheep. So you count anyway. But I think that here's a possible representation of the semiosis of the act of counting, taking into account that we have these psychic representations. So if there is an intermittent element here, an event that is repeated, can I get it repeated like this? Then the counter will turn his cycle. The first one would be a 1, now it's a 2, next time it will be a 3, then it will be a 4, and then it will be a 1 again. And then you could run on and on. So that's a pulsation of beats, in fact. So that the pulsation of beats undergo a grouping by the application of the psychic symbolization, which makes it possible to organize the assemble here. This my first example would be musical, but bodily rhythm of numerical singing, for example, 1, 2, 3 is something that kids do from the first day. That's their first entry to mathematics, is by music, so to speak, on a pulsating beat. What are you going to do when you hear that beat? The beat can be like laid out by the mathematical teacher, for example, and the kids will be happy to fall into it. What are we counting? Arrays or displays, arrays of things or displays of acts, I would say. So when I phrase it like this, I think one of the exemplary cases would be a rhythmic cycle of named beats in measures in music, where the pulse of beats will be experienced as different from the cycle, because the pulse of beats is given in shared time. It can be marked gesturally in a group of people that can be in and out of the beat, and they have to count in the same way in order to understand where they are in a musical sequence, which is then a display of phrases, of tones and non-tones, or the rest, etc., namely a melody. So melody presupposes this thing, namely that you have a symbolization of the beats that are given into. So what's going on here when you express a perception of a series of signifiers like this, cyclically, is that the expression throws a signifier on first beat and a new signifier on the next beat, and instead of going on forever, like Borges's Funes Memorioso, you will stop the cycle and go and take it from start, of course. And that's the way we count. For example, in jazz music, 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 3, 4, 4, 2, 3, 4. That's a sort of elementary math, very elementary. But it corresponds to something which is important in the framework of the study of minds and brains in human beings, namely that music is a basic semiotic activity. We have brain cycles. So there are indications of brains functioning rhythmically. Sequentiality has a time frame that is given by the speed of neural activity. Concept time is 10 times slower than simple perception of sequentiality, for example. And then 10 times slower than conceptual reality, we have a time window detected by the German neuropsychologist Ernst Pöppel some years ago. He calls it the 3-second window. Turns out that the 3-second window is a standard unit for simple utterances. So why do languages have utterances? Well, because it's part of the brain's rhythm for thinking. We don't think in a flow, we think in cycles. Therefore, it's at least possible to show that grammar is built on cycles, namely cycles of complementations of heads of syntactic structures. And when complementation is fulfilled, then it starts over again, and we get the famous recursivity that the generativists were so fond of. But this one is regulated because of the way the brain works. I would like to show you something as an example of how this works in what we could call natural music. Music that's not written, it's just dance. Get it? 3-3-2-2-2, 3-3-2-2-2. Sort of thing you get. This is called flamenco, and flamenco music came from India, where also the Indo-Arabic numerical system stems from. You can't play Indian chamber music, for example, Vaga music, without being able to do this, with very long bars of 12, sometimes uneven numbers in Vaga, like bars of 13 beats. Those beats will have to be subdivided. In the case of flamenco, I have studied it a little bit in detail because the underdivision is specific by genre. And in order to describe what's going on there in the subdivision of the bars into sub-bars, I have to suppose that what we are dealing with is in fact a structure of cycles with cycles in them. So not only do we get one cycle like this, but we get, here's another example of how people do this. You cannot dance without counting. This is an American flamenco chorus, corresponding to what we just saw. This is a chorus for beginners. Guitars are doing is almost music, I would say. But the most important part is what the bodies are doing, namely getting the tempo out of the song. What the hands are doing here stems from the Indian and Balinese handwork in dancing. Right. beats in long bars. Here is a flamenco bar, cyclically represented. Of course, after the three, you go into a new three, which is in the long cycle. And after the 12, everybody is in agreement where number one is. If you miss number one, then you are lost. Like in all natural music, if you miss a beat in a bar, you have to find a good excuse. So they have to be counted, and the counting has to rely on numbers. I would say this is interesting because the same principle of cycles, of symbolization of entities in time, things in time, talk like Berkeley things, they have to be symbolized. So here's a Mexican, an Aztec calendar doing exactly the same time, namely symbolizing events in time so that they can be shared. The difference between dancing and looking at your schedule organized by a calendar is that dancing is, of course, proximal. Like music is a little bit, non-danced music, academic music is a little more distant. But the most distal version of this would be a calendar time. Now, Aztecs were very good at multiplication and division and had very strong numerical developments of their mythology. So here is an Aztec cosmology. In Aztec cosmology, Aztec calendar is a very important part of their mathematized religion. I found a description of it which corresponds rather closely to what I had seen when I started Aztec semiotics many years ago. Namely that the explanations you get for the naming of the temporal symbols refer to divinities. The thing is, you have to have a calendar in order to do a decent cult of your divinities. If you celebrate, you have, for example, 48 divinities, you can't celebrate them all at the same time. They'll be angry, and society will go down, of course, weighed down by misery and mishaps. So we have to distribute the cult of the divinities. So this day is for this divinity, this other day is for another divinity. So it's about distribution of divine force. You come up with, for example, the Tonal Powali, that's the sacred part. There is another Powali for the 365 days. This one has a system of cycles that generate a year of 260 days, namely by integrating a cycle of 30 days into a cycle of 20 days. So then when the 20 comes back, it doesn't land on the same one. They are not on the same beat until 259 days later. And being on the same beat is then starting something new. So here's, you are on the same or not in the same time. To be in the same time or not the same time is a basic principle of human life, and it's symbolically established. So here is how they name, the Aztecs named the days that are components of the bigger cycle, the 20 days cycle. You could say that's a very long week, in a sense, instead of 7 days. By the way, Genesis is doing the same thing. One of the Genesis is just theological explanation of a cycle of seven. There is a number, and then there is a dedication to a divinity. So like a day has two names, like a first name and a second name, like myself, like Pierre Brandt. The first one is the number, the other one is the divinity in this case. See what they use as number signs. It's almost Funes el Memorioso. Crocodile, wind, house, lizard, snake, death, deer, rabbit, water, dog, monkey, dry herb, cane, jaguar, eagle, vulture, earthquake, knife, rain, flower. if you had to dance to that, you would have to speak fast. No? But that's what it is, and what it does is that it distributes the cult to the respective divinities in such a way that they don't overlap too much. And then, it, of course, the calendar in this way explains to people how to live directly. Here's the other one, the, namely the cycle of 13. Here you have some more accurate number names, like 1, 2, 3, Je, Ye, Makuli, Chikome, etc., etc. And then you have a divinity as second name again. Now when you run one cycle on the other cycle, then you get two numbers and two divinities implied, and they are never the same. So it's possible to organize service, religious service to two gods on the same day. That's possible, but not 48. And then the third thing is that each of the weeks of 30 days that we just saw has a name as such when it runs into the bundles of 20. So the first week has a number name, which is taken from the animal kingdom, Chipastli, Ocelotl, Masatl, etc. Here is a rabbit and here is an etc. And then it has a god name. So in a week you dedicate your service to a specific god, and then in each day of that week you dedicate it to two other divinities, which is still a distribution instead of a fatal concentration that would make the universe fall apart. And then you project all that onto the day of 365. This is done by cycles of 18 times the 20 days plus 5 last day of the year. This is the 5 Nemontemi days where nothing good will happen, because there are no gods that are active on those days, and you can't contact them. So you should stay in bed totally on those 5 lugubre days. Those are impossible to use for action. So my point here is that Aztec math is based on multi-cycle naming as an example of how we organize time units of whatever size. And whatever size, I mean, we can go back to a musical beat, 1, 2, 3, 4, and we can go up to a day, or we can go up to a month, or we can go up to count years, etc. It's the same mechanism. The ancient Greeks had seen a relationship between what math is doing and what other cyclic processes of the universe are doing. Of course, there was a philosophy about that. Well, the thing is, if you have a cycle A running on a larger cycle B of whatever kind, and A has fewer stations in it that have to be symbolized than B, and A station names are different from the B station names, then any temporal station or beat will have these two determinations. But in the first station of A, if it doesn't coincide with the first station of B, until all stations of B have been passed, then, of course, the number of stations in A is multiplied by the number of stations in B. That's what happens to the Aztec 260 days year. But if the first station of A coincides with the first station of B after one tour of B, then the number of stations in B is divided by the number of stations in A. So by applying cycles to cycles, you get multiplication and division for free. That's what they had, and they developed it into their sacred mathematics, in fact, in the same way as many other calendar systems are developed. See, for example, the Catholics have saints distributed over the year so that you can have a name day coinciding with the saints' day. That's an ancient archaic practice that's essentially doing the same thing. Or name your child after the name day, the name day of where you are in the cycle, and you get a way to inscribe your next generation in time. So what I'm trying to tell you here is that numbers are names of events in temporal cycles, of beats, days, or events in general. Polytheism, of course, calls for calendars needed for temporal distribution offered to each divinity, as I said. And human proper names are then available as names of the birthdays. Wednesday, for example, is still Odin's day. We are still half into a Viking sacred calendar, still in our days. That's the way proper names work. We should do more semiotics of proper names in order to understand symbolization as such, I think. They are the likely origin of numerical symbolization, I would say. Therefore, numbers seem to be related to not to things in space, but to things in time. In fact, that's the way humans manage to live in time and still be on the same beat. Quid fuit demonstrandum. Thank you very much. Yeah.